All right, good morning. Happy Father's Day. Yeah, so this is not a Father's Day message. Although Nebuchadnezzar had children, so I guess if we're going to make it work, there it is. All right, I'm very happy to be back here with you all again today. So if you haven't turned there yet, please turn with me in your Bibles to Daniel chapter 1. Daniel chapter 1, and we are doing a three-week series that we started last week called A University Experience, and we're looking at the contemporary university through the lens of Daniel 1 and the first half of chapter 2 in particular. And what we're doing is we're using this text to ask some particular worldview questions. Can you turn my mic down just a little bit? It's a little hot up here. Thank you. We're asking some worldview questions, and I explained last week what that meant, that a fundamental worldview question is something that every person has to deal with at some point in their lives, and the worldview is the grid through which they process that reality. Every person on the planet has a worldview. They have the lenses through which they view reality. It's just a question of what are they made of, and are those lenses corrective or not? And the question we looked at last week is, who or what is behind human history? And we looked at how Daniel and his three buddies were taken from their home in Jerusalem, and they were transported nearly 1,000 miles away to modern-day Iraq, and they were forced to enroll in the University of Babylon. And we looked in the opening verses about Daniel explaining not just what happened, but why. And he lets us know that Jerusalem fell under siege by the Babylonians, and that's not really that big of a deal. But the big deal that he let us know is that it is Yahweh, it is God who is behind human history. And that's really important. If we get that first question wrong, then the other three are going to be wrong or skewed as well. So we have to make sure that we understand who or what is behind human history, because if we understand the grand story, then we can understand our story. And that was something that must have been very important for these four young men who were stuck here in a place that was far from home and in a culture that was vastly different from the one that they grew up in. Now, these questions that we're dealing with are not siloed. So if we deal with one, the first one we dealt with last week is who or what is behind human history. We're looking at the second one this week, which is what is absolute or what is really real. We shouldn't see them as being totally separate, having nothing to do with each other. That's not the case. They are interrelated. That's why I told you getting the first one right is paramount, necessary to getting the other ones right. So we need to make sure that we understand that. So again, this week we're going to be looking at this question, what is absolute, what is really real? Another way of asking this question, there's different ways we can come at the fundamental issue from different angles. Another way we could ask that is there anything that is objective versus is everything subjective? Is there anything objective versus is everything subjective? Now, this question is not just a biblical issue. It is not just a religious issue. It is not just a church person issue. This is an everybody issue. Is there anything at all that is objective? And it comes down to the fact about things like even asking, is there a God or not? That is an objective question, because asking that question, he either exists or he does not. He cannot both exist and exist at the same time. That would make it subjective. That's impossible. Another area where this comes into play is the area of ethics, asking what is right versus what is wrong, and how do I know when I should do the right thing. Now, let me give you an example of how this is not just an ancient issue, but it really is a contemporary issue. I attended a monthly philosophy discussion group for a little while in Scranton. It was among one of the most frustrating things I've ever done in my life. It met in a public library, and I think they're still going there in Center City. And this group of people who basically all knew each other, except for me, would get together once a month, and they would democratically decide what it was they wanted to philosophically discuss for the next 90 minutes in this discussion group, which is nice. Democracy. Woo! We get to choose. So they would choose, and it was really frustrating because no matter what they decided they wanted to talk about, the end conclusion was, and that's why Christians are stupid. Every time, I'm like, rrr. And so I'm doing my best to try to interject some thoughtfulness into this group. And of course, you know, I'm just the radical, aisle-rolling, Bible-thumping, pew-hopping weirdo. And it really didn't go anywhere, and so I finally had to just stop going, because sometimes wisdom is the better part of valor. And in those kinds of situations, if you find yourself in a situation like that and you think, oh, I have to walk away and I failed, do not think that, because you might be doing those people far more good by going home, getting on your face, and begging God to help them in the name of Jesus than getting a quiver lip and crying and screaming at them. Just saying. Right? Okay. But the last time I attended, it ended spectacularly. They decided they wanted to talk about this very issue. Objectives, absolutes, are there any in the realm of ethical concerns? Is there an objective standard for right and wrong? Now, again, in this group, I'm going to assume most or all of you would say, well, of course. Now, that is the simple answer. The more complicated way of dealing with that is, and how do you know that? How do you know that? We're not going to have time to get into that today. But they wanted to discuss that, and as you might imagine, they were pretty convinced that there is no such thing as an objective standard of right or wrong. Now, they had two ways that they wanted to view it. Now, one of the popular ways is simply called subjective relativism. That's what it means. And what subjective relativism means is that any people group or any culture gets to choose their own right or wrong, yes or no, and they can never impose that on another culture. Now, there's all kinds of issues with that, because if that is the case, then we cannot condemn the actions of Nazi Germany. Think about it. If they're right, we cannot condemn the purges of Stalin's Soviet Union. We can't. We can't say that any culture is wrong because what they do, nor can we actually say we are right. We can't do that, whether it be a church culture or an American culture. So there's all kinds of problems. So some argue that, and the young woman sitting next to me argued for the other popular notion when it comes to ethics, which is simply called ethical egoism, which says the right thing to do is up to the individual. You get to choose the difference between right and wrong. How many of you have ever been to a public high school graduation? Come on. Well, then you've heard it. Because some knucklehead, whether it be the valedictorian or the special speaker, will get up in front of the group and say something really fantastically ignorant, like, hey, graduates, as you cross this platform for the last time and you go out to make your mark on history. Well, okay, that's altruistic. I don't have a problem with that. But honestly, what 18-year-old is really thinking about making their mark on history at that point? They're more concerned about where's the after party and how do I sneak home when it's over. That's what they're considered. So, whatever. But then it's the next part when they say, and as you go out to make your mark, do not let anyone tell you what you can or cannot. So you've heard this speech. You are the masters of your own destiny. You captain your own ship. You are the designer of your own fate. Oh, yeah. Yes, I am. Which is reinforced in every Disney, Pixar, DreamWorks, and Sony animation film. Every single one of them. And this young woman sitting next to me was adamant that that is the way that it must be. Now, just by the fact that she's making the statement that it is absolutely or objectively true that every person can make up their own right or wrong is full of philosophical issues. But we'll let that go. And so I'm trying to argue, no, there is an objective standard, and if we know the God of human history, we can know the objective standard because it is part of his character. Not because he chose what is right or wrong or he recognizes what is right or wrong, but it is part of his character. That is the Christian answer. It also happens to be the biblical answer and the philosophically correct one all at once. Nice. And she was mad. Have you ever met a really angry fundamentalist Christian? where their strategy is to beat Jesus into people with a 40-pound Thompson Chain Reference Bible. Well, bam! Have you ever met somebody like that? She's the polar opposite. She's the angry atheist, and she's just blah! She's really just going crazy. Just there's no way there's any God going to tell her what to do. I'm thinking, all right, how am I going to help her with this? So I look down, and her right foot is about 18 inches from my left foot, and between our feet is her purse. Now, her purse is just a simple bag, leather bag, with a big banana-shaped zipper across the top. So I prayed a quick prayer beseeching the God of the universe, and it went like this. Oh God, let her see me before this goes too far. This is a true story. And I reached down, and I very deliberately and slowly pulled her purse over in front of me, and I began to unzip it. Now, men, you would never, ever touch a woman, another woman's purse, would you? No. In fact, there are some of us in this room who get ulcers, you know, because it doesn't, we're just like, eh, I could comb my hair, but why bother? So I'm ready to go. And you're sitting and you're getting ready to go someplace and you're watching the game and then the voice comes from upstairs. Honey, could you bring me my phone? Where is it? It's in my purse. No! Where? Well, it's in the pocket. Like there's only one. Right? You know, when that happens to me and I have to get my wife's purse, I don't like going in there without a safety blanket, extra food, rescue flares, because, you know, repelling gear. I don't know if I'm coming out. So I realize what I'm doing is objectively wrong. I know that. So I'm just opening it a couple teeth at a time. And I'm about an inch and a half in, and mercifully, in an answer to prayer, she sees me. Now, I cannot give you a direct quote of what she said. I have to clean it up. But in essence, she wanted to know what in the world I thought I was doing. So, I apply the cheesy philosopher grin, and I say, I'm going through your purse. And she said, well, you can't do that. I said, why not? She said, well, but because it's wrong. I said, why? Because it's wrong. And we went back and forth like three-year-olds for a couple minutes. And I said, listen, you've been arguing for the past 45 minutes that right and wrong is totally up to the individual. You say it's wrong, you go through your purse. I say it's right. I'm going through your purse. And she says, but you can't do that. And I said, dude, but why? And then she said, because everyone knows that. And she literally put her hand over her mouth. Stop talking. Thank you. I zipped it up, shoved it back over, and that's the last time I went because of the threats upon my life. But this is part of the issue. Is it really, now is it in the grand scheme of things the most important ethical issue we could talk about? No. Right? And is it objectively wrong to open another woman's purse? Well, probably, I don't know. But it does make the point that we do have to consider these issues of yes and no, right or wrong. I want to go back to Daniel 1:1. We're going to pick up there again. And we're going to be looking at a lot more of the narrative today. And we're going to be jumping around in the first half of the book of Daniel. Here's what it says. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. The year is 605 B.C. And the Lord delivered Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand, along with some of the articles from the temple of God. These he carried off to the temple of his God in Babylonia and put in the treasure house of his God. So Daniel gives us what just really seems like an incidental piece of information here. Like, it's like, well, I got to write this essay and I got to fill in the words because I have to meet the minimum, so I'm going to add some extra stuff. And it just seems a little incidental that he tells us about these vessels that Nebuchadnezzar took with him. And he went and he put them in the museum, if you will, of one of his gods, Marduk, Ishtar. I don't know which one. He doesn't tell us specifically, but he does tell us that there's something happening here, and he tells us something that is not uncommon. So when one king lays siege to a neighboring city-state, like we have with Babylon and Jerusalem, it is not uncommon for them, A, to bring tributes of people back to their city, and we looked at that last week, and we'll continue to look at that this week, and stuff, prizes. Hey, look at some of the stuff they had. We brought it back to show you how powerful we are. And again, this is commonplace in siege warfare from ancient days all the way up into the medieval world. It still happens, right? So, but the thing about these vessels is that this is not just incidental. These vessels are going to represent the downfall of the entire Babylonian Empire. Cups are going to represent the downfall of the entire Babylonian Empire. They have a significance. And within that significance, we're going to deal with this question, what is absolute? And then we're going to hopefully get to the second question today and deal with that too, and we'll be left with the fourth one for next week. So, in trying to understand this issue of asking what is absolute, what is really real, we have two really good biblical stories that illustrate this. And the first is found in Daniel chapter 4. So I want you to turn over there with me. Daniel chapter 4. And the story of Nebuchadnezzar. Now, Nebuchadnezzar, at the beginning of Daniel chapter 4, is the biggest, baddest, toughest dude on the planet. He is the all-powerful, megalomaniac ruler of the Babylonian Empire. There are no real rivals. There's one coming very quickly, the Persian Empire. But at this time, there are no real rivals. He reigns supreme in the Middle East region. It is his. Comfortably from his kingdom and his palace there in Babylon. Now, to understand who Nebuchadnezzar is and some of the things he's seen, I just want to remind you of what happened in the previous chapter. In chapter 3, one of those classic VBS material passages that I love to preach on, in the story of the fiery furnace that involves Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, a.k.a. Mishael, Azariah, and Hananiah, which are the names they probably called themselves, not their pagan Babylonian names. And in that scenario, we learn that the megalomaniac Nebuchadnezzar decides to show his vast empire how awesome he is by building a 90-foot tall statue and dedicates it to himself, probably in the shape of an obelisk. That's the shape of the Washington Monument. Probably that kind of shape. This thing overlaid with gold, and he orders all the officials for the entire empire to come at a specific time. We're talking thousands of people to bow down in front of that thing. And so then the herald comes out and he says, okay, we got the ancient praise band up here, and he lists off all the instruments, and he basically says they're going to hit the power chord. Wow! When they do that, everybody's going to drop on their face, and they're going to worship the statue slash the man. So they hit the power chord, and woof, people from all over the known world hit the ground on their face, and the dust rises, and here's Nebuchadnezzar up on his dais watching all this, going, I knew I was awesome. This is great. Right? And then the dust settles, and some of his like tattletale guys go to him and they say, hey, there are three Jews who will not bow down to you or the image you have set up. And there stands Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Everybody's like bowing. They're tugging on their togas, like, get off me, man. I'm bowing to that. And he calls him forward and he says, hello, did you not hear what's going to happen? You're going to get hucked in a furnace if you don't bow down. And he said, I'm going to give you one more chance, and then what God is able to save you from my hand. And they say, well, listen, you can throw us in the furnace. Our God is able to rescue us, but even if he does not, we will not bow down to you. So put that in your furnace and smoke it. And you know the story. And they go. Nebuchadnezzar sees his math is pretty good. He says, wait, we threw in three. I count four, and the fourth looks like a son of the gods, some kind of divinity. It could have been a pre-incarnate Jesus. We don't know specifically. And then they come out. Of course, they're not smelling of smoke or singed in any way, and Nebuchadnezzar makes this great decree no one will speak ill of the God of Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, because if they do, I will have you chopped into bits and your houses turned into piles of rubble. That, by the way, is his favorite altar call. You will see that again. And essentially he says, your God is awesome. And they said, I know, right? We were trying to tell you that in the first place. I mean, we've been down this road before because Daniel and these boys refuse to have a private faith in God. They're going to have a high-profile public witness for God in a hostile environment. And it's because they know the answers to the questions. And they all are in agreement. Not the boys, the answers to the questions. So that's Nebuchadnezzar. You would think he would know. He doesn't yet. So I'm going to paraphrase some of chapter 4. I'm going to read a few verses. We're going to spend more time in chapter 5. But for time's sake, I just want to paraphrase for you what is going on. So let's read a few verses in Daniel chapter 4, beginning in verse 1. King Nebuchadnezzar, to the nations and peoples of every language who live in all the earth, may you prosper greatly. It is my pleasure to tell you about the miraculous signs and wonders that the Most High God has performed for me. Not to me, not against me, not around me, for me. How great are His signs, how mighty His wonders. His kingdom is an eternal kingdom. His dominion endures from generation to generation. Who's writing this? Who's writing this? Nebuchadnezzar is writing Scripture. Think about that. King Nebuchadnezzar is writing Scripture. And he wants to tell his testimony. And he says, I want to tell you what the great God has done for me. And then he starts talking about how he had a dream. You can fact check me. Please read this on your own. It won't take you very long, but it would take a lot of time this morning. So if you will allow me, please, to paraphrase. He has this dream of a great tree. Trees are very symbolic in the world of religion. Are they not symbolic in Christianity? Yeah. Are there trees in the beginning? Is there a tree in the middle? Is there a tree at the end? Oh, trees! Right? And Christianity is not the only place that you find this idea of trees. You find it in other ancient cultures. The Norse religions of the Viking peoples had their own sacred tree. So it's everywhere. We see sacred trees all over the place. So he has a dream about a tree, this great tree who provides shade for the whole world, who provides food for all kinds of birds and animals, shelter for them, places for them to live, sustenance for them. This is the place where everybody goes and they find life. They get to get it from the tree. And the tree is mighty and its branches extend from horizon to horizon and it reaches to the top, up into the stratosphere. This is the great tree. And then he says, as he's seeing this great vision and all the stuff that it does in verse 13, in the visions I saw while lying in bed, I looked and there before me was a Holy One, a messenger coming down from heaven. Oh, he's going to tell me how awesome the tree is. He called in a loud voice, cut down the tree and trim off its branches. Wait, what? Well, hold up. Hold up, messenger guy. I am providing for the entire world. Yeah, so you said. Strip off its leaves and scatter its fruit. Let the animals flee from under it and the birds from its branches, but let the stump and its roots bound with iron and bronze remain in the ground in the grass of the field. Wait, you're going to cut it down. Mm-hmm. You're going to scatter all the animals. Yes, you're paying attention. And then you're going to leave the stump and you're going to chain it to the ground? That seems a little excessive. Let him be drenched with the dew of heaven and let him live with the animals among the plants of the earth. Let his mind be changed from that of a man and let him be given the mind of an animal till seven times pass by for him. Verse 17, the decision is announced by the messengers. The holy ones declare the verdict. You have been judged and the verdict is given to you. so that the living may know that the Most High is sovereign over all kingdoms on earth and gives to them, to anyone He wishes, and sets over them the lowliest of people. If you mark, highlight, or underline in your Bibles, do so with verse 17. It is key to understanding this idea of who, of what is really real, what is absolute. Is there an objective? Yes or no? Again, here's why this is happening. So that the living may know that the Most High is sovereign over all kingdoms on earth and gives to them anyone He wishes and sets over them the lowliest of people. This is the dream that I, Nebuchadnezzar, had. Now, Belteshazzar, tell me what it means. For none of the wise men of my kingdom can interpret it for me, but you can, because the spirit of the holy gods is in you. Which, he's wrong. His gods have nothing to do with Daniel, which we'll talk about next week. So he brings in Daniel. He tells him the dream. Daniel's already interpreted a dream for him back in chapter 2. And we're going to look at that a little more specifically next week. So he wants to know what's going on. So Daniel recounts the dream back to him in verses 19 through 23, and then the interpretation comes in verse 24. Again, fact check me, but for time's sake, in verse 24, this is the interpretation, Your Majesty, and this is the decree the Most High has issued against my Lord the King. You will be driven away from people and will live with the wild animals. You will eat grass like the ox and be drenched with the dew of heaven. 7 times or 7 years will pass before you until you acknowledge that the Most High is sovereign over all kingdoms on earth and gives them to anyone He wishes. The command to leave the stump of the tree with its roots means that your kingdom will be restored to you when you acknowledge that heaven rules. Again, if you mark, highlight, underline in your Bibles, do so with verse 26. The stump is being left until you lift your eyes up and you understand, and your kingdom will be restored to you when you acknowledge that you are not sovereign, but your kingdom has been given to you, that heaven rules. Therefore, Your Majesty, be pleased to accept my advice. Renounce your sins by doing what is right, and your wickedness by being kind to the oppressed. May it be that then your prosperity will continue. I love the fact that Daniel adds his own commentary at the end of this. He says, look, here's the dream. You're in big trouble. And think about the guts it takes for Daniel to tell him that. Again, Daniel's not content with a private faith in God. He's interested in a high-profile public witness for God in a hostile environment. I will tell you what the dream means. You are in deep, deep trouble. Everything you know is going to be stripped from you, and you're going to be reduced to an animal. But there's a time coming, Your Majesty, when your kingdom will be restored, when you realize that it is heaven that rules. And he says, and here's the commentary, be nice. Maybe it doesn't have to be this bad. Verse 28, all this happened to King Nebuchadnezzar 12 months later. A year has passed. 12 months later, as the king was walking on the roof of the royal palace of Babylon, he said, is not this great Babylon I have built as the royal residence by my mighty power and for the glory of my majesty? Even as the words were on his lips, a voice came from heaven. This is what is decreed for you, King Nebuchadnezzar. Your royal authority has been taken from you. You will be driven away from people. You will live with the wild animals. You will eat grass like the ox. 7 times will pass by for you until you acknowledge that the Most High is sovereign over all kingdoms on earth and gives to them to anyone He wishes. Immediately what had been said about Nebuchadnezzar was fulfilled. He was driven away from people, ate grass like the ox. His body was drenched with dew of heaven until his hair grew like the feathers of an eagle and his nails like the claws of a bird. Now, in the illustration that I have up here, this is from William Blake in 1795, a painting simply called Nebuchadnezzar. And you can't see it as well from the projection. I encourage you, if you have some time, look it up in high definition on your computers and take a look and just look at it and study it and look at the colors. Blake captures, I think, pretty well in his imagination what is going on here with Nebuchadnezzar. In fact, as I was reading about this painting and I was studying it, again, you can't really see it, but he's starting to turn green. He's like turning into some kind of reptilian type creature. He's losing almost all vestiges of his humanity. Everything has been taken from him. He's been reduced to the lowliest of low. For 7 years. Why? Because Nebuchadnezzar thought he was the ultimate. Verse 34, at the end of that time, I, Nebuchadnezzar, raised my eyes toward heaven. Stop right there. Symbolic, poetic, important, beautiful. Can you imagine the stink coming off this dude? After 7 years? I mean, not just his breath, but his body. I mean, gross. And after 7 years, his eyes are no longer looking toward the earth, but they look up. I am a kind of person, if you dared to sit and watch a movie with me, I warn you, I am the kind of person that ruins movies for people. Not because I tell you the ending, although I do that sometimes, particularly in my philosophy class. Not because I ruin the ending, but because I see movie theaters as the stained glass windows of the 21st century. Some of you are not quite sure what I mean by that. Every director, writer, producer, or actor is trying to tell you what they believe about reality. And they're doing so in very compelling ways. Every single one. Okay, maybe not all movies are at the same level. I'm not sure that there's a deep meaning in Nacho Libre. It is for fun. But there are, thank you for the person who got that joke. But most of them do. A couple years ago, a movie hit the screens. It was called Interstellar. And I went to see it because it was directed by Christopher Nolan. He is a thoughtful director. I will see just about anything that he makes. And it was a philosopher's movie with a nice sci-fi overlay. And it's a story that happens in the not-too-distant future where something is happening on planet Earth and we are no longer able to grow stuff. In fact, the only crops that are surviving are okra and corn, and in that movie, the okra crop is failing, and the only thing left is corn, and so they're having a discussion, what's going to happen? Because, well, if we have no plants, we have no food, we're going to starve to death, and also no plants, no oxygen. So, some of the conversation at the beginning of the movie is how are we going to die, by starvation or asphyxiation? It's a pleasant option. And the story centers around a man named Cooper, played by Matthew McConaughey, and you know he's getting older because he doesn't take his shirt off once the entire movie. Let's face it, if I had his physique, I would never wear a shirt ever. But he plays this former NASA pilot, and for all you know, NASA has been disbanded, and so scientists like him are using their skills to try to figure out how to just eke out a few more crops from the Earth. And there's a scene where he's sitting next to his father-in-law on the front porch of his house, and everything's covered in dust. It's like the new Dust Bowl. And he has a conversation, Cooper does, with his father-in-law, and he says this, and this is where I would have nearly had a seizure there in the movie theater because he was quoting Isaiah 8. And he said, you know, there was a day where we used to look up into the sky and wonder. And we would ask, where is our place among the stars? But now all we do is we see dirt. In Isaiah chapter 8, at the end of that chapter, in one of Isaiah's prophecies of the great cataclysm that is to come, he said, a day will come where man will shake his fist in the face of a God he cannot see and does not know. And his eyes will be cast earthward, and he will only see darkness, gloom, and despair. And by the way, I will sort of ruin that movie for you. They never do look up. They look to the heavens, but they don't look to heaven. Nebuchadnezzar raises his eyes. And my sanity was restored. Then I praised the Most High. I honored and glorified Him who lives forever. His dominion is an eternal dominion. His kingdom endures from generation to generation. All the peoples of the earth are regarded as nothing. He does as He pleases with the powers of heaven and the peoples of the earth. No one can hold back His hand or say to Him, "What have you done?" Verse 37, "Now I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise and exalt and glorify the King of heaven because everything He does is right. All of His ways are just, and those who walk in pride, He is able to humble." What is absolute? The righteousness of God. What is surely true? The sovereignty of God. Who is in control? Well, we looked at that last week, but again, these aren't silos. It is God. Where do we cast our eyes? Are they heavenward? Are they horizontal? Or are they down? Or worse, are they merely inward, looking to ourselves for our own strength, our own sustenance, our own identity? Or do we, who claim the name of Jesus of Nazareth, cast our eyes toward His throne? You do realize Nebuchadnezzar is going to be at the marriage supper of the Lamb, right? I have dibs. Sit next to him. Get in line. So it turned out pretty well for Nebuchadnezzar, did it not? His grandson, not so much. Chapter 5. Belshazzar, not to be confused with Belteshazzar, although their names are quite similar. So, a number of years have passed between chapter 4 and chapter 5. In fact, chapter 5, with Belshazzar being king, is the year 539 B.C. It has been 47 years since Jerusalem has been destroyed. Remember, Daniel arrived there in 605. It is now 539, and scholars believe that at the time of Daniel chapter 5, he is 80 years old. 80. He's been around for a long time, having a high-profile public witness for God the entire time, risking his life over and over. Chapter 5 is no different. Verse 1, King Belshazzar gave a great banquet for 1,000 of his nobles and drank wine with them. So Belshazzar, Nebuchadnezzar's grandson, he can party like it's 1999, right? So he's got it going on. So they got like the dancers down from Nineveh. He's got his country western band up from the southern reaches of Babylon, and so they're playing Red Solo Cup on repeat, right? And while Belshazzar was drinking his wine, he gave orders to bring in the gold and silver goblets that Nebuchadnezzar, his father, had taken from the temple in Jerusalem so that the king and his nobles, his wives and concubines might drink from them. Well, that's smart. So Belshazzar is loaded. And I don't mean rich. All right? He's three sheets to the wind, whatever euphemism you want to use. So these guys know how to party pretty hard. And he has this idea. Right? Can't you just hear him in his like drunken slur? "I have an idea. Let's drink out of the vessels that Grandpa stole from the Jews. The beer would taste extra good in that." So they bring him in. These are the vessels of Daniel 1, verse 2. These are the vessels of Daniel 1, verse 2. It is not incidental. But Daniel told us that that is there. So they brought in the gold goblets that had been taken from the temple of God in Jerusalem, and the king and his nobles, his wives and his concubines drank from them. Now that's bad enough. Because God Himself has said, these things are set apart for a specific purpose. You could use the word holy for those, or sanctified for those. Now we need to stop and talk about a theological issue here. What is at stake is something that we really can't be guilty of today, because there's only one entity in the entire universe that can either be holy, unholy, or in our contemporary church time, it can be Christian or not Christian. Do you know what that is? A person. So, technically, there is no such thing as a Christian college. Now, I know what it means, so don't be angry with me, right? We're on the same page. But you can't save an institution. There is no such thing as a Christian bookstore or a Christian movie. Most of them are abysmal anyway. Or a Christian high school, Christian radio station. They just, I get it. I understand, and I'm not saying they have no value. Please, don't misunderstand me. All I'm saying is that there's one entity that can be sanctified versus unsanctified, and it is a person. Okay? So we need to get that on the table. But in this economy, that's not the case. There are things that you use for a specific reason. That's it. So it's bad enough that they're drinking out of them in a drunken orgy. Verse 4, as they drank the wine, they praised the gods of gold and silver, of bronze, iron, wood, and stone. Oh, no. That's where it really gets ugly. They praised the gods of material. Suddenly, the fingers of a human hand appeared and wrote on the plaster of the wall near the lampstand in the royal palace. The king watched the hand as it wrote. His face turned pale, and he was so frightened his legs became weak and his knees were knocking. Well, one thing is going to sober you up pretty fast. It's going to be that. Right? So here we have in this 1821 painting by John Martin. Again, it's hard to see in this resolution, but you Google it and you'll find it. Right? Can you imagine? He's so proud of himself. He's so arrogant. And the hand inscribes on the wall. Now, I don't know how you picture it. It's okay. I picture it kind of small. I don't picture it that big. I don't know. It's just how I picture it. But this freaks him out, and he says, what are we going to do? No one knows what this means. And then we get to verse 10. All right, now this is my... I have a strong youth pastor gene, right? I'm an eighth grader on the inside. How many of you remember the 80s sitcom, The Nanny? Right? Fran Drescher had that horrible, very distinct, nasally Long Island accent. All right. Just for fun, let's give that voice to the Queen in verse 10. Just for fun. The queen said, the queen, hearing the voices of the king and his nobles, came into the banquet hall. May the king live forever! I'm not going to do the whole thing. She said, don't be alarmed. Don't look so pale. There is a man in your kingdom who has the spirit of the holy gods in him. Again, wrong. In the time of your father, he was found to have insight and intelligence and wisdom like that of the gods. Your father, King Nebuchadnezzar, appointed him chief of the magicians, enchanters, astrologers, and diviners. So she's talking about Daniel. He's like, let's get him out of retirement. So he's in the wizard's retirement home. He's taking his Centrum Silver. There he's hanging out. Let's get him in here and let's put him back to work. And he says, great. So they bring him in, and Daniel's brought before the king, and Belshazzar says, is this you? Can you do this? I know that you did stuff for my grandfather, Nebuchadnezzar. And he says, if you can interpret this sign, I will put a garment of purple around your shoulders, and I will put chains around your neck, and I will make you the third highest ruler in the kingdom. So it would be Belshazzar, Grandma, and then Daniel. That's the order, because he doesn't want to depose Grandma. I mean, who does? Verse 17, Then Daniel answered the king, keep it. Oh, this is good. I don't want your stuff, man. Put it away. Nevertheless, I will read the writing for the king and tell you what it means. Now, can't you see Daniel getting close enough to see it? Maybe it was huge. I don't know. You know, like 100 font, and he didn't have to get that close. There he is. You know, he's tromboning because he doesn't have progressive lenses, and he's trying to see it. And he finally reads it. And I wonder what his internal reaction was. What would yours be? Think he was mad? Think he was felt vindicted? Think he was happy? Or do you think he was heartbroken? Pick up a verse 18. But your majesty, the most high God, gave your father Nebuchadnezzar sovereignty and greatness and glory and splendor because of the high position he gave him. All the nations and peoples of every language dreaded and feared him. Those the king wanted to put to death, he put to death. Those he wanted to spare, he spared. Those he wanted to promote, he promoted. And those he wanted to humble, he humbled. But when his heart became arrogant and hardened with pride, he was deposed from his royal throne and stripped of his glory. He was driven away from people and given the mind of an animal. He lived with the wild donkeys and ate grass like oxen. His body was drenched with dew of heaven until he acknowledged that the Most High God is sovereign over all kingdoms on earth and sets over them anyone he wishes. But you, Belshazzar, his son, have not humbled yourself, though you knew all this. Again, get out your pens, verse 23. Instead, you have set yourself up against the Lord of heaven. You have had the goblets from his temple brought to you, and you and your nobles, your wives and your concubines drank wine from them. You praised the gods of silver, gold, bronze, iron, wood and stone, which cannot see or hear or understand. They're dead, man. And these are the things that you worship. But you did not honor the God who holds in his hand your life and all your ways. And he reads the words, mene, mene, tekel, parson, and he says, here's what it means. Mene, your God has numbered the days of your reign, brought it to an end. Tekel, you have been weighed in the scales and found waiting. And then peres, or parson, which can either mean division, or with the right vowel points mean Persia, which is a pretty good play on words, so God knows his words pretty well. That's kind of cool. He says, this night, the Persians are taking over the kingdom. And because Belshazzar had been partying so hard for so long, he ignored the fact that the Persian Empire was laying siege to Babylon. They diverted the Euphrates River and walked in under the walls without firing a shot. Killed Belshazzar, and the kingdom ends. Because of cups. There are two dangers here that I want to bring to your attention, and that is relativizing the absolute and absolutizing the relative. Relativizing the absolute and absolutizing the relative. Belshazzar is guilty of the first. In some ways, he relativized the absolute with the cups. And he decided, I'm going to give them a value of my own. I'm going to decide on a gratuitous value system for these things. And I'm going to use it in my way. Absolutizing the relative, Nebuchadnezzar was guilty of that, where he said, he looked at himself as king. He said, no, I am absolute. I am sovereign over all things. Until he had a dramatic appointment with the God of the universe, who led him to understand that that is not true. We do the same thing all the time, and it happens in our universities, it happens in our churches, it happens in our homes. We relativize the absolute. We take things that God has said, this is the way it is to be, and we say, no, this is the way I want things to be. This is the same tactic the enemy has been using from the beginning. Did God really say? Oh. Now that you put it that way, Satan, maybe I had it all wrong. In the university, the absolute gets relativized in areas of literature. How do we know what an author really means? Guess what other book that then gets applied to? History. How do we know what really happened? Is not just history, the recordings of the winners of history. And they get to tell the story the way they want. They get to spin the narrative. They get to use alternative facts. They get to write the story with fake news. And then going up the scale then gets to beliefs, then become relativized, and then facts. And then the very queen of it all, truth itself. Well, you can believe whatever you want, can't you? Well, not according to Paul in Romans chapter 1. The wrath of God is being revealed against those who subdue the truth. For what can be known about God is plain to them from what has been made, so that man is without excuse. Um, we're not going to have time to go through the second or the third question today, but I'm going to give it to you, and we're just going to kind of have to skip it and go on to number four next week. But the third one is, what is my identity? What is my name? And if we were to go back to chapter 1, we would then read about how Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, as they're forced to enroll at the University of Babylon, they are given a meal plan, ID cards. And that's the famous story where Daniel and his friends, they say, we're not going to eat the meat that comes from the king's table, probably because it was sacrificed to idols. We don't know that for certain, but that's the most logical explanation. We're not going to do that. Because they respectfully stand their ground with the king's officer that Ashpenaz has set over them. He's the dean of students, by the way. And we learn that their names have been changed. Again, this is common in siege warfare because the conquering kingdom wants to change everything about you. Make no mistake, every college or university on the planet is trying to reorient your children's identity. I will say it again. Every college or university on the planet is trying to reorient your child's identity. The question is, into whom or what and by what means? Daniel's name, Daniel, God is my judge, changed to Belteshazzar. May Marduk protect his life. And the other three, their names are all changed. Everything about them was changed. They were probably turned into eunuchs. They have no family. They have no support group. They have nothing. And at the end of the day, they're offered this great food coming from the table of the king that is probably used in the sacrifice to the vast pantheon of false gods. And they say, no, we could eat it and maintain a private belief in God, but that would destroy our identity. I know my name. Who are you? What is your name? You see, the interesting thing, ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to be done in 5 minutes here. Despite the fact I had a full 45 minutes, I'm terribly sorry. So, the enemy isn't going to come up to you. He's not going to come up to Nolan Schmidt. Say, Nolan, I know you're a child of the king, but I'm going to change your name to Abaddon or some demon's name. And Nolan's like, oh no, my whole identity, no, Satan, please. Satan knows that frontal assaults rarely work, especially against an old Marine like Nolan. But he knows that's true about all of us. Again, I invite you back to the garden and the symbol of the tree. Did God really say? And he doesn't come at us with frontal assaults. He comes at us from the side and he says, I just want you to give up just a little bit. Just a little. Are you sure God really said that it is absolute, husbands, to love your wives as Christ loved the church and being willing to give his life for her? You really want to give your life for her? As grumpy as she is every day? Come on. Don't you think you should just do something for you? Women. He comes to you and he says, yeah. I know that it's absolute. You're supposed to honor your husband. What a doofus he is. Wouldn't you just feel better if you took matters into your own hands and maybe you should be leading this family? Just think of how much better it'd be for you, for kids, and for him. Yeah. And to all of us, the enemy can approach and say, oh, yes, fine, yeah, your name is written in a book that you haven't seen, and you're given a new name, and it's on a stone, blah, 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 I know. But you really want to wrap your identity in a being that you have never, ever seen? You're relying on that being alive from an old book that you cannot verify? Which is not true, by the way. It just picks at it. It says, you know, I don't want you to give up believing in God. The enemy rarely does that. I just want you to give me a little. You still go to church. You still do your small group. You still sit around and talk about your feelings and how that just gives you a warm fuzzy inside. I want you to have all the warm fuzzies that you can handle. just surrender. In the summer of 480 BC, Western civilization, as we know it, was on the brink of collapse. Another character that we find in the Bible, his name is Xerxes. You can read about him, particularly in Esther. Wanted to finish what his father could not. That would be Darius or Darius for you snooty vocabulary people. Darius that you read about in Daniel. Darius, in 10 years earlier, sailed a vast Persian army across the Aegean, and his goal was to destroy Athens in retribution for fomenting revolt in the western provinces of the Persian Empire, modern western Turkey. Well, he didn't get that far, Darius. He was met by the Athenian army at a little shore town called Marathon. Got beaten pretty bad and sent back to his ships, and that's when the runner runs the 26.2 miles from Marathon back to Athens, declaring Nike, Nike. You would say Nike, Nike. Victory, victory. And then he died, which proves running kills. So 10 years later, 10 years later, Xerxes says, I'm going to finish the job. And according to Herodotus, which his name in Greek means I make stuff up, Herodotus says that he embellished a little bit. He said that Xerxes put together a 2-million-man army, the largest army the world had ever seen. He said that they drank rivers dry. And Xerxes was not going to mess around, so he had a pontoon bridge built across the most narrow part of the Aegean, the Hellespont, between Asia and Europe, Turkey and Greece. And he marched his entire army across this pontoon bridge with the goal of burning Athens to the ground, which he did, but was defeated in two major battles, one at sea and one on land, and he was too sent packing. And Athens was rebuilt and became the golden age that I study and some of you are aware of. But he chose 480 BC in the summer on purpose because the Greeks were involved with the Panhellenic Olympic Games. If you think sports are religious in this culture, you have no idea as compared to the Greek culture. Same thing Paul was addressing in 1st and 2nd Corinthians. There in Corinth, they worshipped three gods, one of them the god of athletics, among others. Poseidon, by the way, if you're wondering who that is. Aquaman, for those of you into DC Comics. He knew that the armies would not be able to get together a good defense. He knew that. And there's one guy from the southern Greek city-state of Sparta. His name was Leonidas, and he said, we will stop him. I know y'all got your games going on, but we are going to stop him until you can get your act together. Get a unified defense, because Greece is not a unified country. It is city-states that share culture and religion, and that's about it. He said, we will stop him long enough for you to get your act together, and I will only take my 300 chosen knights and whoever else wants to join us, and I know that we're all going to die. So he marches his little army up to a small pass in the mountains of eastern Greece called Thermopylae, and there he met the Persian army. And the Persians had never seen anything like this before. The discipline, these are the special forces of the ancient world. And for days they are slaughtering the Persian. Xerxes, we are told, set up a throne to watch the whole melee because he liked watching those things. And for days he watched his elite, the 10,000, also known as the immortals, be mowed down day after day. And he knew it was only a matter of time. Eventually, these guys are going to be killed. But he offered a rare chance of clemency to Leonidas and his men. We are told that through an interpreter, he hollered down to Leonidas and he said this, Leonidas, I'm very impressed with you and your men. I've never seen anything like this before. In fact, I'm so impressed, I'm willing to give you your lives. There is no reason for you to die here today. You can live on to fight another day. You can continue to be the Greeks and believe in the culture and the gods that you always had. It is not your lives that you want. It is your weapons. Lay them down. We are told Leonidas looks up and makes eye contact with the great king. He is begrimed with the blood, guts, and gore of his enemy. After days of fighting, he is exhausted, shield shattered. spear broken, down to fighting with just his teeth and nails. And he looks up and he offers Xerxes a two-word reply. Molon labe! Come and get it. You want it, you come take it. I will not lay my weapons down. Imagine if in the 21st century, those who claim allegiance to King Jesus stopped surrendering at every opportunity. We no longer confuse relative and absolute, and we know our names and our identities, so that when the day comes, we too can take our stand to make a high-profile public witness for God in a hostile environment and maybe make a dent in history for the cause of Jesus Christ. What if? Or like so many generations who have come before us, we can simply play it safe and hand off the baton to the next generation. I say it is time to stand. Josh.